I know you're going to dig this.
106.6.
That's Ladies First with Messing, and my name's Dom Robinson, and you're listening to the DVD Fever Show with Dom Robinson. This is a new weekly show where I look through the week's releases in movies and video games, plus the charts, a look at what's new on TV, and news for all three. Previously called Movies, Games and TV. I changed the title to coincide with my website, dvdfever.co.uk, which is non-profit and has recently had a revamp, so please have a look. If you've got anything to say about these or everything that's on the show, get in touch via the Facebook page. That's if you search for the DVD Fever Show with Dom Robinson, that'll bring it up. And I know I've managed to get the internet access sorted out in the station, so yeah, just I'll be able to have a look and see what you're saying as the show goes on. And if you're listening to the show and you're not on my friends list, just anyone want to add me. At the moment, I've got a picture up of Martin Sheen from Apocalypse Now as my face, because it's much better than my own face, to be honest. A little bit of intro to what's coming up on the show. We're going to start off with a Blu-ray review of The Mechanic, starring Jason Statham. Then we've got this in the first hour. Then we've got the movie charts. Then we've got new cinema and DVD releases, and also some film news. So we're going to start off with The Mechanic. Now, are you familiar with the works of Oscar Wilde? Because Jason Statham isn't. He plays Arthur Bishop, a cold, emotionless hitman who does his best to make the hits look like accidents, as if no one was ever there to commit a murder. And this starts with killing a gangster boss in his own swimming pool. And by the time we got 10 minutes into The Mechanic, Jason Statham had only killed baddies and had intimate relations with women. At what point was he actually going to fix a car? Still, technicalities aside, we learn soon that Harry McKenna, Donald Sutherland, Arthur's friend and mentor, is a target for his next mission. But why? Because he has a meeting with Dean, Tony Goldwyn, also a high-up bod in all of this. The hit came about because 6 months ago there was a mission to take out a very high-profile target in South Africa. All five of the operatives sent there were killed. And since the company only ever allows two partners to know about the details of any given mission, and that this one was only known to Dean and Harry. Oh, it's got to be Harry. The job is carried out quickly, leaving Arthur racked with guilt. Soon after, Arthur meets up with Harry's son Steve, Ben Foster, at his graveside, and gives him a lift to the old man's house, with Steve commenting that he wants to get the men who killed his dad. In short, he takes Steve under his wing after he says he wants to do what Arthur does, but seriously cocks up his first attempt. Apart from the fact that the general plot stretches credibility, what takes it one step further is the fact that Statham plays a character who, as always, clearly only ever acts alone. So why is he working so well with someone else? That just seems to be the most ridiculous thing about it. However, there's a little bit more to it, plot-wise, which you'll find out as you go, even if it is a bit predictable. Even the press release and Amazon reveal what comes next, but why not just let the viewers find out for themselves? Anyone who's a fan of watching Jason Statham kick bad guy ass amidst explosions aplenty is going to buy or rent this anyway. And on that subject, there are some great action and fight sequences. Basically, this is Transporter 4, but without the Audi. I would have to ask, why does this film need 9 producers? I hope there isn't one paycheck to split between them. There's no problems at all with the picture and sound. They're first rate for the high quality you expect from a Blu-ray, and also it's just explosions and gunfire aplenty throughout the whole, throughout the whole film. I mean, there are points where, it could opt for subtlety and tension, but, it just goes for explosions, gunfire, and more explosions. I think I might have mentioned it has explosions. There's a small amount of extras. We've got some alternate scenes, there's 5 of them, including an alternative opening sequence. Well, I felt the original one worked pretty well anyway. In fact, none of these require replacing what's already there. There's also Tools of the Trade, Inside the Action featurette, a bog-standard making-of mixing chat from the key cast and crew members with clips from the film and work-in-progress footage. Don't expect anything groundbreaking here. In addition to this, there's a trailer. Now, one of my bugbears comes up with this disc, because it's another case of putting trailers before the main menu, a bit like a rental video from the 80s. And not only that, but there's also an advert for a chocolate bar. Why do they do this? If anything, the trailers themselves should be in the extras menu. You pay for the disc. Why do you need adverts on there as well? Aside from all that, the film itself, I give it's decent for a Jason Statham film. I give that 7 out of 10. And then the extras are light on the side, but the picture and sound really stand out. So overall, it's a good 7 out of 10 for the whole package. And I'm going to take another song, and after that, we're going to have the movie charts. And got a bit of Dolly Parton singing Joshua. 106.6. That was Dolly Parton singing Joshua, and you're listening to Manchester's 106.6, and this is the DVD Fever Show with Dom Robinson. Now, I'm going to move on to the movie charts section now. Now, again, I'm afraid there's no UK charts, as they've usually been available from a few places like Yahoo and the Internet Movie Database. But they seem to have disappeared from everywhere in recent weeks. I've emailed the Internet Movie Database again to ask them if they're looking into this, and last time I did, about a month ago, they said they were, and then they came back, and then they've gone again. So, absolutely no idea. I mean, if you try and go on their website, it's just, you've got like the ones for, what was it, about 4 weeks ago, which is just, anyway. What we have got is the American top 10, and, I mean, pretty much the first top three will be pretty similar to what's out here. Going straight in at number one, you would expect, is X-Men First Class. Now, that's only taken, it's been a bit disappointing, because it's only taken $56 million in its opening weekend. And The Hangover 2 did really well, and did about $150 million, which is quite something. Anyway, for those who don't know what X-Men First Class is all about, before Charles Xavier and Eric Lenza took the names Professor X and Magneto, they were two young men discovering their powers for the first time. Before they were archenemies, they were the closest of friends, working together with other mutants, some familiar, some new, to stop the greatest threat the world has ever known. In the process, a rift between them opened, which began the eternal war between Magneto's Brotherhood and Professor X's X-Men. Number two, we've got The Hangover Part 2. Again, this is something this is a film I don't particularly want to see. I do want to see the X-Men film. A lot of people like the original Hangover film. I haven't seen it. It looks like a bit of a laugh from the trailer, but what I've read, it does nothing new that the original hadn't already done. That said, to date, it's grossed $187 million. So clearly they're right and I'm wrong. Number three, we've got Kung Fu Panda 2, and that's grossed $100 million so far. Then we've got number four, Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides. And that's managed to gross, that's been out a little while longer, but that's grossed $190 million. The rest of the top ten, we've got number five, Bridesmaids. Number six, Thor. Number seven, Fast and Furious 5. Number eight, Midnight in Paris, which is a romantic comedy about a family travelling to the French capital for business. The party includes a young age couple forced to confront the illusion that a life different from their own is better. Number nine, Jumping the Broom. And number ten, Something Borrowed. Now, we're going to have a little look at some of the cinema releases. I'm going to start off with, Kung Fu Panda 2. Now, the trailers for most of these, most of the cinema releases are on the Facebook page. So if you search for the DVD Fever Show with Dom Robinson, you'll see them all on there. So Kung Fu Panda 2, from the studio that brought you Shrek, Madagascar and Kung Fu Panda. Po is now living his dream as the Dragon Warrior, protecting the Valley of Peace alongside his friends and fellow Kung Fu Masters, the Furious Five. Tigress, Crane, Mantis, Viper and Monkey. But Po's awesome new life is threatened by the emergence of a formidable villain who plans to use a secret unstoppable weapon to conquer China and destroy Kung Fu. It is up to Po and the Furious Five to journey across China to face this threat and vanquish it. But how can Po stop a weapon that can stop Kung Fu? He must look to his past and uncover the secrets of the mysterious origins. Only then will he be able to unlock the strength he needs to succeed. Now, it's got a big cast, which includes Jack Black, Angelina Jolie, Dustin Hoffman, Gary Oldman, Jackie Chan, Seth Rogen, Lucy Liu, take a breath, David Cross, Michelle Yeoh, Dennis Haysbert and Jean-Claude Van Damme. I have a bit of a bugbear about CGI films. They just seem to have no heart to them whatsoever. And I doubt I'll be going to see this one. I didn't go and see the original. Next film out is Mother's Day. Now, we're does make me think, isn't this a bit late, given that we had Mother's Day back in the UK in March? Anyway, in this thriller, three brothers on the run from the law head for home, only to discover that their mother lost the house in a foreclosure. Mother ingeniously orchestrates her son's escape, teaching the house's new owners and their guests a few lessons along the way. And this one there stars Rebecca De Mornay from The Hand That Rocks the Cradle and Risky Business, Jamie King, and Sean Ashmore from the X-Men trilogy. Now, from the trailer, this actually looks like a really good film, with De Mornay going back to being a nut job. It's a shame that she's actually been sidelined for quite some time, because I think she's still rather hot. Anyway, we'll look at one more film, then have another song. Gonna have it's a film called Honey 2. Recently released from juvenile detention, talented dancer Maria Ramirez, Katerina Graham, finds an outlet for her passion with a new dance crew. Now, there's no one famous in this sequel, which comes 8 years after the Jessica Alba original. Maybe if you're a 12-year-old girl, you find this your bag, but it's certainly nothing I have any plans to see. Okay, I'm going to take another song, and we're going to have Fat Larry's Band and Zoom.
106.6.
Okay, that was Fat Larry's Band and Zoom, and you're back on Manchester's 106.6 with the DVD Fever Show with Dom Robinson. And we've still got some new cinema releases to look at, and we're going to take a look, first of all, at Point Blank, which, I mean, I think there must have been a few films with Point Blank in the name, but this is a new French film. The plot is that Samuel Pierre, and I can't do all of these French names, Samuel Pierre, played by Gilles Lelouch, is a nurse who saves the wrong guy, a thief, Rachid Zem, whose henchmen take Samuel's pregnant wife, Elena Anya, hostage to force him to spring their boss from hospital. A race through the subways and the streets of Paris ensues, and the body count rises. Can Samuel evade the cops and the criminal underground and deliver his beloved to safety? Well, maybe find out when you watch it. I tried to find a trailer for this, and I found a trailer for something that said it was Point Blank 2010 when it was originally made, and I don't think it was that. It's everything else you search for Point Blank. It's just some sort of video game gameplay thing. So if you've seen that, heard of it, and know whether it's any good, do get in touch via the Facebook page. Search for the DVD Fever Show with Dom Robinson. A couple of other titles that are out this week. We've got Kaboom, and the premise for that is that Smith's everyday life in the dorm, hanging out with his arty, sarcastic best friend Stella, hooking up with a beautiful free spirit named London, lusting for his gorgeous but dim surfer roommate Thor, all gets turned upside down after one fateful, terrifying night. And that's all it tells you about here. That's got a cast of Thomas Dekker, Hayley Bennett, Chris Zilka, Roxanne Mesquida, and Juno Temple, which seems to be the only name I seem to have heard of. I don't think I can find a trailer for that one, but anyway, again, if you've seen it and you know whether it's any good, do get in touch via the Facebook page. Now, also, there's a film out this week called Jumping the Broom with Angela Bassett. Now, it seems to have made number nine, in this week's US Top 10, and it was a bit higher before that. But I have to say, I tried looking at it, but I fell asleep reading it, really. Okay, so that concludes the new cinema releases for this week. We're going to be taking a look shortly about the new DVDs that are out this week, starting with Romeo and Juliet. But first of all, we're going to have a quick listen to Chris Isaak's Blue Hotel.
106.6.
You're listening to Manchester's 106.6. My name is Dom Robinson, and you're listening to the DVD Fever Show with Dom Robinson. And it's at this point in the show, we're going to have a look at some of the new DVDs out this week, starting with Romeo and, well, Romeo and Juliet. Ho, ho, ho. What a title. Set in the gardens of Fair Verona Drive, we witness the blossoming romance of two young gnomes, Romeo, James McAvoy, and Juliet, Emily Blunt. Excuse me. And Mr. Turf War, between the reds and the blues. Try again. Set in the gardens of Fair Verona Drive, we witness the blossoming romance of two young gnomes, Romeo and Juliet, amidst a turf war between the reds and the blues. Between the high-speed lawnmower chases and stealth missions, hearts and hats are broken. Loyalties are tested and garden boundaries drawn. But can true gnomance conquer all? When your best friends are an overexcitable frog, a lovelorn flamingo, a loyal mushroom, a team of Bond-esque bunnies, and a dopey fawn, there's a shedload of fun and adventure around every plant pot. The miniature moments are voiced by massive household names including James McAvoy, Emily Blunt, Matt Lucas, Maggie Smith, Michael Caine, Stephen Merchant, Ashley Jensen, Jason Statham and Ozzy Osbourne, to gnome a few. Featuring classic and original songs by Elton John and directed by Shrek 2's Kelly Asprey, I'm sure we've all heard of her, Romeo and Juliet is a great love story with a very small difference. Well, I saw the trailer, and again, if you like CGI films, this could well be your bag. But for me, it's just another CGI kids film, so I'm going to give this one a big miss. Next up, we've got 127 Hours, which is a triumphant true story from Danny Boyle, director of Slumdog Millionaire. The incredible true story of mountain climber Aaron Ralston's, James Franco, remarkable adventure to save himself after a falling boulder crashes on his arm and traps him in an isolated slot canyon in Utah. With only a day's worth of water, a blunt penknife and an unwavering will to survive, Aaron does everything he can to make sure he'll go out alive. Special features include, on this disc, a director's commentary, deleted scenes and four featurettes. Now, this is another film I have to confess I haven't seen, but it does look intriguing. However, for me, Danny Boyle's films can be hit or miss. I love Trainspotting, but A Life Less Ordinary and Sunshine were merely okay, the latter of which fell apart two-thirds of the way in. 28 Days Later was good until Christopher Eccleston turned up, and Slumdog Millionaire was dreadful all the way through. I know it won awards and all that, but awards don't always mean everything, and I knew I wasn't really going to like it before I watched it, but I just had a feeling. I thought it would be more sort of set in the studio watching the millionaire programme as it went on, but just in the end, it was just absolutely 2 hours of 2 to 2.5 hours of utter tediousness. And also out this week, we've got The Crimson Petal and the White, which is a compelling Victorian tale of revenge. The Crimson Petal and the White tells a story of sugar, an alluring and intelligent young prostitute. Sugar longs for a better life, and when she secures the patronage of successful businessman William Rackham, she begins to hatch a scheme that will free her from her life in the slums. However, as their worlds become more entwined, Sugar's plans set in motion a series of events that will change both their lives forever. It's an engrossing drama with a twist that viewers will want to watch again and again. So it says here. The DVD release comprises all four episodes as broadcast, plus exclusive deleted scenes and in-depth interviews with the producer, director and various other crew members. Starring Romola Garai, Chris O'Dowd from the IT Crowd, Elizabeth Berrington, who was in most recently the Doctor Who episode, The Doctor's Wife, and Richard E. Grant, who's in everything. Despite all its period credentials and a look of promise to it, I tried to watch it, but it did nearly put me to sleep. I don't know what it was about it. Just absolutely had nothing going for it at all for me. Although I wasn't the only one who thought that. But what do you think? If you have something to say, have a look on the Facebook page. Search for the DVD Fever Show with Don Robinson, and you can have a look on there. Now we're going to take another quick break before we have a look at some more of the releases. And coming up next, we've got Basher. Time and Tide. 106.6. That was Basher with Time and Tide, and you're back listening to the DVD Fever Show with Dom Robinson here on Manchester 106.6. And we're still continuing with the DVD releases, and just a quick shout out to Mike Plowman, who's what do you say? He said he's watched X-Men First Class last night and said it was excellent. Well, I do want to say it. He should have taken me with him, even though he's miles away. Anyway. Some more of the titles are out this week. We've got Fire in Babylon. In a turbulent era of apartheid in South Africa, race riots in England and civil unrest in the Caribbean, the West Indian cricketers, led by the enigmatic Viv Richards, and the inspirational Captain Clive Lloyd struck a defiant blow at the forces of white prejudice worldwide. Their undisputed skill combined with a fearless spirit allowed them to dominate the genteel game at the highest level, replaying it on their own terms. Now, I'm not a cricket fan by any stretch of the imagination. The only the only sport I watch is snooker. Can't see them making a film out of that. And later on, we'll be talking about video games. They have tried making games out of snooker, but it's not great, to be honest. You can't do with a mouse and a joypad what you can do with a cue. Pardon the expression. That's that. So I won't be watching Fire in Babylon. Also out is Henry's Crime, starring Keanu Reeves. Now, working the night shift as a toll collector on a lonely stretch of highway in Buffalo, New York, Henry, Keanu Reeves, is a man seemingly without ambition, dreams or purpose, sleepwalking his way through life. He gets his wake-up call early one morning when he becomes an unwitting participant in an ill-conceived bank heist. Rather than give up the names of the real culprits, Henry takes the fall and goes to jail. There he meets the irrepressible Max, James Caan, a con man who's grown far too comfortable with the familiarity and security of his idyllic, in quotes, life behind bars, but who also helps plant an idea in Henry's mind which will change his life forever. For a man to have a purpose, he must first have a dream. Ah. Their plan is simple. By infiltrating the theatre and its current production of Chekhov's The Cherry Orchard, the unlikely duo will buy just enough time to dig their way to the adjacent bank vault and drive off with a loot. Unfortunately, that plan also includes Henry taking the lead role in the play, where he finds himself slowly falling for the production's mercurial leading lady, Julie, played by Vera Farmiga. By turns, right, offbeat and simply hilarious, Henry's Crime is a heartwarming story of a man who finds his purpose in life and then finds his destiny. Oh. Again, this is something I haven't seen, but it was a very weird interview that Keanu Reeves did a few months ago. I think it was back in January, when he was on Breakfast one Saturday morning. If you have a go on YouTube and search for, I should have put a link to it on the Facebook page, but I haven't. Have a search for Keanu Reeves on Keanu Reeves talks about Henry's Crime on Breakfast, and you'll find it, because it's it just sort of the hits on that one just went a little bit mad, because I put that online and just went a bit mad, and the loads of people sort of commenting on how one of the presenters had asked him about this sad Keanu thing, which I hadn't come across before, but it's just bizarre in the extreme. But have a look and just see some of the comments and some people. Anyway, it just ended up being a very it could have been a decent interview, but it just ended up being very, very odd indeed. Some of the DVDs, just a quick summary of some titles that are out this week. We've got First of the Summer Wine Series 1, this stuff on TV. Yeah, First of the Summer Wine Series 1. Lead Balloon Series 3. We'll be taking a look at the first episode of Series 4 later in the show. The Politician's Wife. And a complete box set of Star Trek The Next Generation, which if you get that from Amazon, that'll set you back up about £140. There's also a DVD, this is a bit long incoming, of Yes Union, their tour, the Union tour. And I saw them tour in 1991 at the time of the Birmingham NEC at the time of the album's release, and it was fantastic stuff. But 20 years just to finally get a DVD release. I mean, I know DVDs didn't come out until about 98, 99, but still, would have thought, you know, it'd be something they might have got round to sourcing out before 20 years had passed. Some of the stuff that's out this week, we've got some Blu-ray first-time releases for The Bridge on the River Kwai, The Fifth Element, Taxi Driver 35th Anniversary Edition. Yes, where have the years gone? And separate releases for each of the Godfather trilogy. And all of these are around, well, all of these Blu-ray titles are around about £13 or £14 on Amazon, which is not bad, because I think the retail price is about £20 each. But, you know, if you leave it about 3 months, they'll all be down to about £7 or £8, or in the £3 for £20 bargain bin. Okay, so that's all your DVD releases. You're up to date with that. And now we're going to have, in a minute, we're going to have some film news. But first of all, we have a bit of music, and we've got a new song from Duran Duran, Cut to the Chase. You're listening to Manchester's 106.6.
106.6.
Listen to Manchester's 106.6, and that was Duran Duran with Cut to the Chase. Now, we're going to have a bit of film news for you. We're going to start off, listen to the DVD Fever show with Don Robinson. I should say who I am and what you're listening to, and that you're also on Manchester's 106.6. Now, the film news begins with a fifth Beatle biopic. Is it biopic or biopic? Anyway, on manager Brian Epstein, gets financing and secures rights to the songs. Competing biopics about famed Beatles manager Brian Epstein. Competing biopics about famed Beatles manager Brian Epstein? It sure looks like it. But at least one production has taken a decisive step forward. Back in 2009, a film called A Life in the Day was said to be in the works. Producer David Permut, Youth in Revolt, had acquired a Tony Gittleson's written script about the life of Beatles manager Brian Epstein, who discovered the band, went round to every A&R man in the UK to get them signed, eventually landing them a deal with Parlophone, at the time largely a comedy label, with their longtime producer, George Martin, and notoriously signed away Beatles likenesses and merchandising rights in terrible deals that lost the band millions. He was also their rock, one of the few people the Beatles would listen to, and his death in 1967 of a drug overdose was a huge factor that directly led to the band's breakup in 1969. But little did we know about the fifth Beatle. However, according to a recent report in the print edition of The Hollywood Reporter, and confirmed on the official website of the film, managed by the producer-screenwriter Vivek J. Tiwari, the fifth Beatle has secured $25 million in financing for the film, but perhaps even more importantly, they've landed the rights for up to 10 songs by the Beatles, including All You Need Is Love, A Day in the Life, and You've Got to Hide Your Love Away. Beatles songs are notoriously difficult and expensive to license, so this is a real coup and certainly a big step for the film. Certainly, to Ari's experience in producing the stage musicals of American Idiot and The Addams Family, likely made him familiar and confident in what negotiations for the songs would entail. But the Beatles tunes will be beefed up by contributions from Nitin Sawhney, Joe Jackson and Robin Hitchcock, the latter of which is contributing three songs, Hurry for the Sky, I'm Falling and TLC, each of which appeared on his 2009 album Goodnight Oslo. The song TLC is a reference to triptizole, librium and carbrittle, the drugs Epstein was taking before the end of his life. A bit of film news we've got. Is Naomi Harris headed to James Bond 23? After breaking through in 2002 in Danny Boyle's 28 Days Later, Naomi Harris seems poised for big things. She's landed roles in a number of Hollywood movies, including a couple of the Pirates of the Caribbean films, Miami Vice, Street Kings, Ninja Assassin, and most recently and notably, had a role in the critically acclaimed The First Grader. Earlier this year, she was briefly rumoured for a part in the currently delayed The Dark Tower mega-franchise, but another blockbuster series appears to have been interested in the actress. The News of the World recently reported that Harris will be Daniel Craig's sexy sidekick in the soon-to-be-filmed new 007 film. But the actress herself is playing the cards a bit more close to her chest. In UK interviews for The First Grader, she's confirmed that she has been talking with the James Bond 23 producers, but wouldn't reveal for which role or even if she will take it if she's been offered the part. Harris is a great talent and we'd hate to see her wasted in a Bond girl role. But if it's a meatier female character, she'd be a great addition to the cast. But as usual, as it usually goes with the Bond franchise, more names will start being tossed around as casting gears up. The film is expected to start this autumn with Sam Mendes directing. The still-untitled film will hit UK cinemas on October 26, 2012, with a US release following on November the 9th. Now, soon after the release... this is something about for all Star Trek fans. I've got a bit of news for you. Soon after the release of the latest Star Trek, Paramount announced the release date for the sequel of June the 29th, 2012. That seemed doable a few years ago, but with the film not yet in production, and that date now 1 year away, does writer-director J.J. Abrams think it's possible? He said the following to Cinema Blend: "I care much more that it be good than it be ready. I'm obviously doing everything I can to make sure that schedules don't get screwed up, But I don't think anyone wants a movie on time that's not worth your time. We want to make sure it's done right. The guys I've been working with are obviously brilliant, so I'm really excited to get back into it. And he added some more info to his discussion with Collider. I really don't know if Star Trek will make its release date, but we will see. We are working really hard to try and get that movie made as soon as possible, but we don't want to rush anything. The worst thing that we could do is put something into production to make a release date instead of a great movie. Well, I mean, I watched the first one, and the guy played, the guys who played Spock and Bones, they were the best in the film, but the guy they got to play Kirk, was it Chris Pine? Do me a favour, absolutely awful. They just came across as cocky rather than as Kirk, basically. And as much as Simon Pegg can be decent, he just seemed a bit overexposed in Hollywood, and getting him to play Scotty was just a majorly, majorly bad idea. Anyway, so the latest on the film, Abrams said that for the sequel, the writers are hard at work on it, and I am excited about getting back to it. We are taking our time, though, because I really do want to make sure we do something that is worthy of the first one. And what about the rumour that Paramount has already asked him about shooting the film in 3D? He said, I'm not yet considering 3D, but, you know, I haven't got any phone call from people in suits. I know what's good for me. Before the month is out, we'll probably have a lot more information on Star Trek 2. Chances are that, much like the first film, which was scheduled to come out at Christmas, but was then bumped to the following summer, it'll move back a few months. Okay, so that's the end of the first hour. Coming up in the second hour, we've got a mixture of video games and TV, starting with a review of L.A. Noire on the Xbox 360. First of a couple of songs we've got going up to the top, I've got Curiosity Kill the Cat and Down to Earth. 106.6. Okay, that was Peter Andre with Behind Closed Doors, which, for my money, is where he should stay, really. You're listening to Manchester 106.6, and this is the DVD Fever Show with Dom Robinson. Just before the news, you had Curiosity Kill the Cats, Down to Earth, and Frankie Goes to Hollywood with Warriors of the Wasteland. Now, in the second hour of the show, we're going to be taking, first half hour, we're going to be taking a look at some video games news and reviews and a bit of everything else. And after that, we're going to be having, there'll be a review of L.A. Noire on the Xbox 360 in a minute. And after that, after the half past hour, we're going to be looking at some TV with a look back at the latest series of Doctor Who. Okay, so we're going to start off with a review of L.A. Noire on the Xbox 360. In L.A. Noire, you play Cole Phelps, a cop recently promoted to detective in 1940s Los Angeles, hoping that someday a real rain will come and wash all this scum off the streets. Hang on, that's from Taxi Driver. Anyway, you get the idea. Violence and corruption are rife, and you and your partner have to travel from one location to the next, trying to get all the info out of the wrong'uns and assess who's telling the truth and who's talking out of their trilby. The cases begin with a woman's missing husband while his car has been found full of blood, followed by a male hit-and-run victim with blood on the street a fair distance from the body, and you have to track down the real story and apprehend the bad guy, or sometimes just shoot them dead if they present no option. There seems to be no penalty for killing them either. If this was set in the present day, there'd be an endless court case to get to the bottom of it. The way to find out the culprit is to search for clues by going to various locations, picking things up and manipulating them to see if you can gather more information, such as a brand name on a pair of glasses, then enable CGI scenes of interviewing eyewitnesses and subsequently deciding whether they're lying or not, picking from a selection of topics to ask them about. However, you can't always just go through a list until you've exhausted them all. You often have to choose which two or three you should ask. However, this does get all a bit tedious after a while, because you just basically just keep walking around examining a crime scene until the music stops playing in the background, at which point you know there are no more clues left to find. And if you can't find anything, you just use up intuition points to find them. This does make for a rather linear experience, though, because in terms of who you interview in what order, which is a shame because the game is set in what they call a sandbox environment, i.e. that you can go anywhere and do anything, and it doesn't live up to that. Also, when you interview a suspect, you can tell when they're giving you the runaround, as they have very obvious tells. Also, the driving sections aren't brilliant. When you steal another car, rather than threaten the driver, Cole Phelps just waves his warrant card and tells him it's an emergency. There's a lot of driving in this game too, but you can skip this between scenes by holding Y to make your partner, Bukowski, get in the driving seat instead. Then as soon as you set off, the picture fades out and fades back in at the destination. The chase sequences need some work as well. For example, when you're running from one route to the next, you don't have to time the jump between them. You just run up to the edge and Cole will do it all for you. These will sometimes result in a fist fight, which can be amusing for a while, but they do all get a bit samey. On the plus side, the game evokes great period features with good motion capture, but the speech leaves the mouths looking odd when it comes to synchronising with the voices. Also, there's around 25 to 30 hours of gameplay, so you do get a lot for your money. As an aside, Phelps himself does come across as being a bit rude. He hardly ever says please and thank you when he speaks to anyone, including the operator when he needs to make a call to the station. And on that point, he often does this from a victim's house without even bothering to ask. Maybe that's what it was like 70 years ago, I don't know. I wasn't around. Additionally, after less than 10 minutes of gameplay, the game froze. Now, I've heard about this happening following a required Xbox Live update in order to continue playing the game while signed into Xbox Live. However, for me, it only happened once. L.A. Noire also includes something called the Rockstar Games Social Club, which unlocks rewards and enhances your gaming experience. I unlocked the Chicago Lightning outfit, which improves your accuracy with various weapons, and this outfit soon becomes available as soon as you reach the rank of detective, which comes pretty soon. I should add that after a few missions, things do get a bit more involving as you get promoted, including taking part in shootouts, but they're still not fantastically well handled, and by default the gun almost always shoots straight at the bad guy. Rockstar have managed to get the atmosphere right with this game, excuse me, but the mechanics leave an awful lot to be desired. Also, after a high-energy game like the GTA series, which they released, it's a bit odd to have to slow down in a world that expects exactly that. Still, if you can lap up the atmosphere, then there's plenty of it, then maybe it's more for you. And I've also put some example gameplay footage up on the Facebook page. Now, in terms of what I'd give this as a rating, the graphics and sound, I'd give them 8 out of 10. They're not bad. Playability, 7. But enjoyment, it's only a 5. I played a few of the missions, and I don't think I'll be going back to it, to be honest. It's also got an 18 rating, but not really quite sure why, because it's not... I suppose you can go around and you can take your gun and shoot whoever like you can with Grand Theft Auto, but it doesn't really sort of lend itself to doing that, given the atmosphere. But maybe that's why they had to give it an 18, but I think a 15 would have been all right. Overall, he'll get a 7 out of 10. Okay, before we have a look at the game's charts, we're going to have another song, and this one's going to be Maxine Nightingale, Love Hit Me. You're listening to your Masters 106.6.
106.6.
That was Maxine Nightingale and Love Hit Me. And just before I go through the video games charts, just seen on the Facebook page, Mike Plowman, he's corrected me. There was a film, to come back to the movies in the previous hour, there was a film made about snooker, which I didn't know about, with Bob Geldof. It was called Number One, and he played a character called Harry Flash Gordon. And that was released in 1985. So I'd never even heard of that, actually, but I think I might take a look at that later on. But in this section, we're going to have a look, first of all, at the charts. And then after a bit, we're going to have a look at some video games releases. Starting off with the charts, once again, L.A. Noire is number one. Number two is a new entry for Dirt 3, which is another driving game. Never enough driving games, are there? Dirt 3 from Codemasters will boast more cars, more locations, more routes, and more events than any other game in the series, including over 50 rally cars representing the very best of five decades of the sport. With more than double the track content of 2009's hit, Dirt 3 will see players start at the top as a professional driver, with a top-flight career in competitive off-road racing complemented by the opportunity to express themselves in a Gymkhana-style showpiece during events. As players race to elevate their global standing, Dirt 3 delivers mud, sweat and gears. Oh, world over from the intense, weather-beaten rally stages of Europe, Africa and the US, to executing performance driving showcases and career challenges where car control is pushed to spectacular limits. Now, you can buy the console versions as you would any other game, but oddly, the PC version is a digital download only. I've no idea why they're doing that, but I don't like that becoming the norm for a major release. I mean, what if you change your PC? I mean, I prefer to play games on a console now anyway. It's just now that, you know, consoles and they've pretty, you know, caught up in terms of how fast they can run games, you don't need to spend a fortune on a PC. I do have a fast PC, but I tend to use that for recording gaming footage rather than playing the games themselves. But anyway, I mean, if you are into PC games, you know, give us a shout on the Facebook page and let me know what you think about whether that's a good idea to have digital downloads for PC games. Next up in the rest of the chart, down to three, we've got Lego Pirates of the Caribbean. Staying at number four, we've got Zumba Fitness. Down to number five is Brink. Number six, up to number six, is also a re-release of Wii Sports Resort. And number seven is, up to number seven is FIFA 11. Up to number eight is Call of Duty Black Ops. I mean, both of them have been in the charts for, you know, a good 6 months, six, 7 months. Down to number nine, Crysis 2. And up, another re-release, up to number 10 is Mario Kart Wii. There's no other new entries in the top 40 apart from Dirt 3, but a couple of re-entries. We've got number 32, we've got Killzone 3 on the PS3. And number 35, Call of Duty 4, Modern Warfare, which that's about 3 or 4 years old. So I'm not quite sure why that's suddenly banged straight back into the charts again. Anyway, taking a look at some video games releases, which are out this Friday. Finally, we've got Duke Nukem Forever. Now, when I saw this due to come out on this coming out, you know, June the 10th, I didn't believe it, because basically this is a game that's been out. Well, the original Duke Nukem game came out in, or Duke Nukem 3D rather, came out in 1996. And for one legal reason or another, and changing hands along the way, it's taken, well, after the name Duke Nukem Forever was first mentioned as being touted as a sequel in 1997, it's taken 14 years to finally get released. Anyway, intended to be groundbreaking, Duke Nukem Forever has been infamous in the video games industry and became synonymous with vaporware due to its severely protracted development schedule, because, as I say, the game's been in development since 1997. The first game was originally, you know, so Duke Nukem Forever was originally developed by 3D Realms and finished by Gearbox Software. Now, it says it's part of the long-running Duke Nukem video game series. I'm sure we had a couple of games before the 3D one, which were, well, 2D ones, but you know, whether we're going to get a third 3D first-person shooter, I have no idea. There's also a Balls of Steel Collector's Edition, which contains a copy of the game in Balls of Steel exclusive packaging along with the following. A collectible bust of Duke Nukem, numbered limited edition certificate of authenticity, 100-page hardcover book about the history, legacy and legend, Duke Nukem Forever art from the vault. There's also a Duke Nukem Forever postcard series, radioactive emblem sticker, collectible comic book, foldable paper craft, poker chips, mini card deck, and radioactive emblem dice. Now, another big releases are out this coming week is Infamous 2 on the PS3. Cole McGrath is back, more confident, with more focus energy burst abilities. Blamed for the destruction of Empire City, Carl must take a dramatic journey to discover his full superpower potential and face the final confrontation with a dark and terrifying enemy. This being a creature of pure power and destruction is annihilating the East Coast. To stop this menace, Carl must find the key to unlocking his undiscovered powers hidden deep within New Marais. Standing in the way is a power-hungry dictator that will stop at nothing to rid him from the city. Gain enough power to defeat the beast or witness the destruction of the world. The power is in your hands. Like its predecessor, Infamous 2 is a single-player action-adventure game set in an open-world game environment. Players take on the role of Cole, the returning anti-hero from the first game. Possessing electric burst abilities through his hands, Cole's matured a bit as a superhero type, being more confident and focused in his abilities. and he uses these, as well as improved melee possibilities, to battle enemies both large and small in mission-based gameplay. Along with combat, choice remains a big part of the game, with an improved morality system that allows for two separate endings to the game, depending on the choices that Cole makes. Now, unlike the original game in the series, Infamous 2 contains significant user-generated content tools that dramatically expand gameplay possibilities. Centered around a creation tool system, this allows players to create original missions and share them with other players via the PlayStation Network, rather like Little Big Planet. These function more or less as side quests once they are accepted, adding to the player's point total, but not altering the primary mission flow and morality-based aspects of the game. Now, I don't have a PS3 though, so I can't play this particular game. But if you do, and if you've tried it, if you've played it, or if you're going to be buying it, say what you think about it on the Facebook page. So have a search for the DVD Fever Show with Dom Robinson. Okay, I think before we have a little bit of video game stuff, we can have another little song, and we've got The Glory of Love from Peter Cetera. 106.6. That was Peter Cetera with The Glory of Love. You're listening to Manchester 106.6, and this is the DVD Fever Show with Dom Robinson. Now, just before that song we were listening to, I was telling you about, some of the new games releases are out this week, and there's also one more biggie. We've got Red Faction Armageddon, which is a new third-person shooter and the fourth instalment in the Red Faction series. Now, the gameplay takes place on the planet Mars, and it's set in the year 2170, 50 years after the events of Red Faction Guerrilla. Since the liberation of Mars, the surface of the planet has become uninhabitable. This occurred when a massive terraforming machine on Mars, which supplied it with its Earth-like atmosphere, was destroyed following the strike of a huge meteor, causing super tornadoes and violent lightning storms to engulf the planet. In order to survive, the colonists were forced to flee to the underground mines of Mars built by their ancestors, creating a network of habitable caves under the surface of the planet and setting up colonies there. He played Darius Mason, grandson of Martian Revolution heroes Alec Mason and Samania, the main characters of Red Faction Guerrilla, who runs a lucrative series of businesses based in Bastion, the underground hub of the colonist activity, including mining, scavenging and mercenary work. Few sane people venture to the ravaged surface of Mars, apart from contractors like Darius and smugglers who transport goods between settlements. Darius is tricked into reopening a mysterious vast shaft in an old Marauder temple by a fanatical Marauder priest, which awakens a long-dormant race of Martian creatures, causing an Armageddon on Mars. Colonists and Marauder settlements alike are torn apart by the new enemies, and the blame for the whole disaster is placed on Darius, soon inciting several angry colonists to form mobs and attack him in their fury. Now Darius must join the Red Faction to clear his name and save the people of Mars, as his grandfather did before him. Now, I've not played this yet, but I will be doing it soon. I played all the three previous Red Faction games. They're all, I mean, obviously the graphics have improved along the way, but the first one was really the best. The third one was all right, but I've seen some of the what you can do with some of the weaponry in this latest one. It does look fantastic. So we'll be bringing you a review of that shortly. Not today. And a couple of video games news bits just to finish off this half hour. Some downloadable content has been announced for L.A. Noire. And Rockstar Games presents the Rockstar Pass video. These are the first details about upcoming downloadable content for L.A. Noire, beginning now, and continuing on through the summer months. There's several standalone cases, collectibles and challenges, and they will be released via the PlayStation Network and Xbox Live, including all of the pre-order exclusive unlockable bonus content, as well as a free downloadable weapon. If you purchase the L.A. Noire Rockstar Pass, it's a new way to pre-order and receive downloaded content that gives players access to all the upcoming downloadable content for the game, available on a limited-time discounted price of just £7.19 on the PlayStation Network and 800 Microsoft points on the Xbox Live. Then later this summer there'll be a couple more cases that are available to download. They're called the Nicholson Electroplating Arson Case and Reefer Madness Vice Case. If you look on the Facebook page, you'll see a full breakdown of the content that you can get. There's all with the pricing and release dates. as well as an exclusive video about the Rockstar Pass. Now, Back to the Future star Michael J. Fox is to voice a character in the video game series of the film. The studio has confirmed that the actor will feature in the fifth and final episode of the game, titled Out of Time. A.J. LoCascio, who portrayed Marty McFly in the previous episodes, will continue to voice the character in the final chapter, and Fox will provide vocals for one of the protagonist's ancestors. Telltale's Back to the Future debuted on PC and Mac last December. The first episode was released for PS3 and iPad in February, and the latest game will be out on PC on June 23rd. Now, just one more little bit of games news. A Hitchhiker's Guide game is in the works. Another one. The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is being adapted into a video game by Hothead Games. The Canadian-based development team, which is known for its library of digital releases, will be working with Megadodo Publications to bring the Hitchhiker's game to life. A press release for the title did not reveal a launch date or platform titles, but it said it will be available not only on your planet, but also on all nearby systems, including Alpha Centauri, I'm sure. Okie dokie. That's all your video games. Everything else to do with that. And in this last half hour of the section, we're going to be looking at a bit of TV. Starting off with some programmes watched in the past week, including a look back at the first half of the latest series of Doctor Who. But just before all that, we're going to have a bit of music from George Michael with As.
6.6.
That was George Michael with As, and you're listening to the DVD Fever show on with Don Robinson, and it's on Manchester 106.6. Now, we're going to have to take in the last half hour section of the show, we're going to take a look at some TV stuff, starting off with some TV programmes watched in the past week. Now, first one I'm going to talk about and have a bit of a moan about is Doctor Who. Now, before, well, normally you just get one series running from start to finish with 13 episodes since it came back in 2005, but now they're doing it a bit differently. They have had 7 episodes, and they're going to have a break over the summer, and then another 6 more to finish it off. Now, last Saturday saw the final episode of the first part of the latest series, and for me overall, Stephen Moffat's tenure has been a disappointment since he took over from the dreadful and self-indulgent Russell T. Davis. Moffat took over at the start of last year, and the first 6 episodes proved to be incredibly engaging, with Matt Smith proving his worth almost from the minute he stepped into David Tennant's shoes. Well, the first episode was a bit on the bog standard side, as our new hero had only made a brief appearance at the end of the Christmas episode, but he and Karen Gillan made some intriguing episodes that knocks anything from Russell T. Davis into a cocked hat, especially with a two-parter featuring the return of the Angels. However, it all fell apart soon after, culminating with a finale that had a Hellraiser-style box named the Pandorica, and then being thrown into an exploding TARDIS, which hit the big red reset button and made everything all right again. And don't even get me started on the Christmas Carol special. This time round, my hopes were high, but they were instantly dashed. Yet again, Alex Kingston was dragged out as Dr. Riversong for what feels like the umpteenth time. I know we'll get to... At that point, I thought, I know we'll get to know the truth about her and what her relationship is with the Doctor, but there are just far too many episodes where she just turns up to smirk a lot, flirt with the Doctor, and then go back to a foxy little prison cell. The Silence were an interesting character, but most of the opening two-parter could have been condensed into one episode, and the actor playing Richard Nixon didn't even bother to do an impression. The Pirates outing was pointless, and The Doctor's Wife was a Marmite episode where some people seemed to think it was the best episode ever made, while some, like me, thought they really did make it all up as they went along. Another two-parter with people made out of the Rebel Flesh was the most interesting episode of the series so far, but even then it wasn't exactly great, and played straight from the book of predictability, with one human being killed off and his doppelganger having to take his place in entertaining his child. Oh, and when it came to a particular moment on Breakfast where Stephen Moffat's words were played back from an interview saying how much he hated the so-called fans who published spoilers online, while he's quite right about this, I actually posted a link to the video of this on Twitter, and even though I wasn't following him beforehand, I found out he blocked me. That was bizarre. Anyway, we then had in the final episode, we had Sontarans, Silurians, the Jardoon, Hugh Bonneville from the Pirates episode, Rory dressed as a Centurion again, and Amy had given birth to a daughter called Melody. And there was a load of headless monks, and Riversong told us that this is the day that the Doctor finds out who she is. Then the baby turned out to be a flesh avatar, as a real one was taken away by the baddies who have yet to be named, and set to be used as a weapon to bring down the Doctor. Huh? They're the ones who also projected a fake Amy signal into the TARDIS, somehow managing to beam it in from the outside. We also saw the Dr. Scott from when he was a child, and initially Riversong made things out as if she was his mum. Yes, his mum. Despite all the kissing in previous episodes. And then the Doctor just went off in his TARDIS, as you do. Then we found out that River was actually Amy's daughter, Melody, all grown up. And then it ended. It returns in the autumn, which for the BBC is usually the first weekend in September, tied in with another series of Strictly Come Dancing and yet more Casualty. Overall, this episode was immensely disappointing for me. It was a perfect case of, let's throw all the old rubbish at the wall and see how much sticks. Moffat was better than this. In fact, at one point I was wondering if, did Russell T. Davies write this one? It's like all these terrible episodes lumped into one. And I thought we'd got away from all that with Moffat. In fact, I just couldn't get away from it being a mishmash of Russell T. Davies cast-offs with a few from Moffat's era all thrown in together with no structure. Now, whatever you think of Doctor Who, have a look on the Facebook page, go search for the DVD Fever Show with Don Robinson, and have your say on there. A couple of other shows that have been on. We've got Case Histories, which has been on, well, it was on, started on Sunday and then carried on Monday, which was an unusual take on the detective genre featuring Jackson Brodie, Jason Isaacs, who has served with the Army and the Police and is now a private investigator. Jackson takes on the mysterious case of a girl who went missing 30 years ago, as well as helping a grieving father to find the man who murdered his daughter, all whilst trying to deal with flashbacks to his own traumatic past. It featured Phil Davis, whose daughter Laura was killed a few months earlier, in a case where he believes it was meant to be him who was murdered. The question was, how does this all connect with 30 years ago, with the death of a girl called Oliver Land, whose sister Sylvia went into a convent soon after to escape having to deal with the grief? Now, filmed in Edinburgh, this was a very slow-moving, and I found the whole thing very slow-moving, and featured the old cliché of a private detective with a dysfunctional lifestyle of a divorced wife and who takes his young daughter to the crime scenes. Also, his wife was about to go abroad to work for a year and thus would be taking the doctor. The daughter, rather. Overall, I felt it added nothing new to the detective genre and just made for two long hours of television. Throwing in extra murders, it also felt like a bit of a mess. There are four more episodes over subsequent Sundays and Mondays, so if the show worked for you. I won't be watching, however. And finally, just in this section, I'm just taking a quick look at Lead Balloon, which started off, on Tuesdays. And that's now moved to BBC Two. So it won't be on BBC Four, that's at 10 o'clock tonight. But the first episode, called Pig, Jack D returns as failed stand-up and serial liar Rick Spleen. His career is at an all-time low. Even the idea of writing a novel gets stuck on page one. So when a Sunday newspaper wanted to do an at-home-with feature about his partner Mel, Rick naturally tries to muscle in on the action. But when he decides that having a pet pig will look good in the photos, Rick proves that if nothing else, he's a prize-winning author of his own downfall. Now, with this, I've loved the previous three series, but I found there was a downside in that there was an underuse of Marty, who co-writes everything with Rick Spleen, which basically he sort of didn't feature much because Rick was having to try to write his novel. But the upside was Magda, who suggested she kill the pig for sausage. I can't do the accent, but if you saw it, you'll know what I mean. But again, there's a scene where Rick just ended up trying to show up Michael, who runs a cafe, even though his life always ended up looking worse. And it was rather blatantly obvious that the pig was going to embarrass Rick just at the moment where it had the most effect, i.e. right in front of those who wanted to interview his wife about her career, with him trying to shoehorn his book in there and them clearly not being interested in that. As Jamie Kilday said last week, as a guest on the show, it does indeed try to do what Curb Your Enthusiasm does a lot better. Because the only problem is that Curb now only seems to get a new series once every 2 years, and with the next one due this autumn. And then just as the third series of Lead Balloon, however, came to an end in Christmas 2008, but before that, it was annual. No, it didn't feel like it had been that long since it was on. Well, that said, it's good to see the show return overall, as it's still better than most things on the box, and also the fact that this is the first time Lead Balloon has premiered on BBC Two rather than BBC Four. However, this series is rumoured to be the last. Now, just a quick look at something that's coming up in the next week. There's a sitcom called In With The Flynns, which is Wednesday at 8:30 on BBC One, which I haven't got high hopes for, to be honest. It says it looks like a, because it just looks like a traditional style of sitcom with canned laughter and not many laughs. But there's not a great deal that's on in the coming week, to be honest. The premise is that young parents Liam and Caroline Flynn are working extra shifts to save up for a holiday. But who is looking after the kids? Chloe gets a piercing in her tongue. Steve has a run-in with a school bully. And Mikey eats food left out the back of restaurants. This is all because Liam's brother Tommy fills the breach with his own idiosyncratic brand of parenting. Meanwhile, Liam's dad Jim has met a woman at a car boot sale. She seems perfect, but Caroline thinks she has met him before and that Jim's romantic intentions are doomed to failure. Can they warn him before he makes a move? This series stars Will Miller, Warren Clark, Nikki Wardley, Craig Parkinson, Ola Poole and Daniel Rogers. And one other thing I'll take a look at next week, it finished last night, but it was previously on every Thursday, Psychoville. Now, if you missed the last episode, that's why it was only on last thing last night, so normally it was on a Thursday, so a lot of people may have missed it, so I'm not going to go into that now in case you've not seen it. But if you did miss the last episode, there's a repeat on Thursday, BBC Two, at 11:20, so I'll be discussing that next week. Now, before we have a bit of TV news, we're going to have another song, and we've got a Flock of Seagulls with The More You Live. 106.6. That's a Flock of Seagulls with The More You Live, and you're listening to the DVD Fever Show with Dom Robinson on Manchester's 106.6. Now, we're going to just finish off the show with a bit of TV news. First of all, starting with the news that Cheryl Cole is to return to the US X Factor. In a huge U-turn by TV executives, Cheryl Cole has been invited to return as a judge on the X Factor, according to reports. The News of the World claims that in a shock move, bosses at Fox have decided not to sack the girl's loud singer from the programme after all. It is believed Simon Cowell intervened after being criticised for allowing her to be replaced after just four auditions. Former Pussycat Doll singer Nicole Scherzinger was due to step in as a fourth judge on the panel, alongside Paula Abdul, L.A. Reid and Cowell. Cowell, who was 27, was reportedly dropped because auditionees were having problems understanding her Geordie accent and did not know who she was. But after a public outcry over the way she appeared to have been treated, it seems Cowell may have wooed her back. The paper claims that the media mogul is frantically sorting out a deal so Cole can rejoin the panel when auditions start again in New Jersey tomorrow. The Sunday Mirror quotes a source close to Simon Cowell as saying, "We've offered Cheryl a second chance and she might still come back to the US X Factor. Fox have been re-examining the situation and have had a change of heart. After the debacle with the UK judging panel, we have started negotiating with Cheryl's camp and the ball is now in her court." And on that, well, on pretty much a similar subject, this sort of leads on to something else that's been prevalent in the news lately about how a bit of a controversial topic of music videos are to face crackdown over sexualised content. Music videos should be given age ratings, according to a report by the Mothers Union into the commercialisation and sexualisation of children. Reg Bailey, chief executive of the organisation, which carried out the six-month review for the Department of Education, found that among parents there was a particular concern about music videos, many of which were seen by parents to be inappropriately sexually suggestive or which illustrate the value or role of women as sexual only. The Bailey Review said the parents would like to see music videos given appropriate age ratings and for broadcasters to take more responsibility over when these are shown. Parents surveyed also voiced concern about the lack of information given on 18-plus rated video games that appear to be openly marketed as a younger audience on pre-watershed television. Now, isn't this just the same as when Hot Gossip used to dance on Top of the Pops and the Kenny Everett Show in the early 80s? Or even, you know, take it one step further, the chase scenes in the Benny Hill Show. Sex sells and that's why they do it. Age ratings won't work unless they're voluntary, like those on computer games, since anything applied to films has to be rated by the BBFC and costs a fair amount of money to do so. However, the review also calls for a single website to be set up where parents can log complaints about adult content or sexualized imagery in TV programs, adverts, products or services aimed at children. Which, I mean, one of the programs that was aimed at kids really was the X Factor. And there was a big furore over Christina Aguilera wearing Not A Lot while singing a bad song during last year's series. Anyway, but about this review calling for a single website, don't we already have that with Ofcom? That's what that's for. And basically, you can't regulate the internet. Each parent should be responsible for what their children should see on TV. That's how I see it. Now, there's also the Alan Partridge web series is to be broadcast on TV, which is good news. Alan Partridge's Mid-Morning Matters. It's been confirmed that the show, the online web series featuring Steve Coogan as hapless DJ Alan Partridge, will receive a TV broadcast. Production company Baby Cow have packaged the online videos into a series of 6 half-hour-long episodes and are currently in the process of negotiating the show's sale to a broadcaster. Discussions are said to be in the very early stages with no confirmations made, but Broadcast Magazine reports that Baby Cow are currently talking to the BBC as well as looking at the prospect of international sales. It is expected that the episodes will air on TV in October. Alan Partridge's Mid-Morning Matters, which was created using sponsorship money from Foster's lager brand, has become an online hit. Consisting of 12 short episodes between 10 to 15 minutes each, the videos feature Coogan's most famous creation presenting his radio show on North Norfolk Digital Radio. And since launching in November, the series, which also co-stars Tim Key and is written by Coogan, Armando Iannucci, Neil and Rob Gibbons, has gained over 4 million hits. It has also been announced that the company is planning to make a second series, but it's not yet known whether the same lager company will be financing it. That's just one little quick bit on the news. Stand-up comedy star Milton Jones is to be working on a sitcom for Channel 4. And Jones, probably best known for delivering surreal one-liners on Mock the Week and for his long-running Radio 4 sitcom, Another Case of Milton Jones, is set to record a pilot episode of The House of Rooms this summer. The daft and silly sitcom will form part of Channel 4's 2011 Comedy Showcase season. House of Rooms, which is a working title, has been written by Jones and fellow stand-up Dan Evans. The premise of the show is that Milton and his mother live in a big house together with lots of other tenants. The residents are out of control, and Milton just must do his best to try and restore order. The programme is being made by Objective Productions, the company, same company behind Peep Show, Pete vs. Life, and a forthcoming university set Channel 4 comedy drama called Fresh Meat. Well, that just basically brings us up to the end of the show today. So thank you very much to everyone who's been listening and taking part on the Facebook page, including Mike Plowman and Lawrence Roberts. And I'll be back again this time next week for more movies, games and TV. Until then, we're going to take it up to the top of the hour with Climby Fisher and Rise to the Occasion. This is Manchester's 106.6.